only you, the only person on the planet, would notice the appropriateness of it.
Or you know, I would have charitably assumed I wasn't the only person in the world to. Anyway, but at the time, this was March of 2002 that Rupert was in Toronto.
Right.
And I just had this piece of paper around. I didn't end up getting around to following this link until the date of July 7th, 2002. 7-7-2002.
Right.
And I had, when I went and followed the link, was I had just finished writing my book. I had been writing. It's not a very long book, but in fact, it's 44 pages long.
Wow.
And I didn't exactly do that. I didn't do that really on purpose, but when I noticed that about it, I thought, okay, great, that's good. Just from the general sort of occult resonance of multiples of 11, I thought, great, 44 pages, that's perfect.
But you did not know at that point that Bin Laden, I'm assuming you had not noticed that Bin Laden on September 11th, 2001 was 44, his seance, the cult guru, was 44, and all this other stuff, 44. I was living on the street with the number 44 at the time. You had not realized that aspect of 44. It's just the occult shape of it or something was significant.
Yeah, it just smelled right. Like, yeah. I had no idea about any of that. But literally, the first thing I did after I finished this book was walked out to Ryerson Computer Lab, actually, because I had a friend of mine was going to Ryerson University, and so I was using his card to go on the internet, and I followed the link and you know, came across this list of articles by Bob Dobbs, which, you know, kind of creates some, like, what? That doesn't make any sense, right? But so then, looking at that, I decided, okay, well, I think the first thing I'll read is this article by someone else about Bob Dobbs, and that was the Guffey article that was linked to there. And so that was my introduction, and then I came back 2 days later and started reading some of your stuff. But then much later, I found out...
Let me interject here. Let me just say this. You say you went... Where were you before you went in the Ryerson Computer?
Over in Cabbage Town is where I was living.
Okay,
Parliament.
Right. So you know that if you can go over to, you went over to Ryerson to use a computer because you had the card.
Yeah.
Right. And little do you know that old Dobbs here had been broadcasting on Ryerson.
Yeah. Zero did I know.
Yeah. So I just want to point that out. And remember, it's at Ryerson where John Cage and Marcel Duchamp have some of their chess games as a performance piece, and I think it's like in 68, right? The year that Duchamp dies. It's one of the last places he's publicly seen is playing chess with John Cage, and, you know, there's photographs of that around in the art world. But that's at Ryerson.
Like right there on Gould Street.
Yeah, in the Ryerson building is where is one of the last scenes of Duchamp.
Well, okay, that's perfect.
Yeah. So you go back to Ryerson to keep reading these articles?
Yeah, but the point is that, you know, and then I found out you were on the radio, and I listened to a bit of the show, and then that October I called in for the first time and talked to you on the air. But the point is that it wasn't until earlier this year when Sleeper put up the intros for the show that I noticed that the first show was that day, 7-7.
Wow, I thought you had noticed that a couple of years ago and had mentioned, but forgot. But you're saying you did
not.
Yeah,
I might have forgotten.
Yeah, I think, anyways, the point is, that is the fact, that the day you discovered me, I was on the radio that day, starting the first show of Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah, your debut of flooding Toronto with a new batch of your stuff was also your debut of flooding me with your stuff. And this was like, and this is me, you know, I had read Revelation X and thought to myself, like, wow, this church is like just that little bit better for anyone who's living in Toronto, because it's pretty intriguing to read this book and find these references to the, like, false church of Toronto, and I wonder what that's about. And then, you know, boom, there, learning all about it.
So you didn't know what the Revelation book was referring to?
No, I did not.
Yeah. You just said there's something going here in Toronto that they got a problem with.
Yeah. And I thought, well, that's curious, but I don't know, I was still a teenager and hyper distracted by everything, so I didn't like go out to investigate that right away or anything.
Okay, so you called, did you hear the second show, you know, July 14th or July 21st, which is McLuhan's birthday?
I don't remember what was the first show that I actually listened to, but the first one I called into was in October when you had Eric Phelps.
Oh, yeah.
Show.
That's where I started criticizing him for relying on books for his evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what was your question, do you recall?
Yeah, my question was just why is it that an expert completely loses their footing and basically starts stammering and has no idea how to respond when someone is coming at them not just fighting with some kind of book knowledge but saying that I was there and I was involved. It's one thing if he thinks you were just completely lying, but,
yeah.
You know, he didn't exactly try to come out with, like, okay, well, how are you going to impress me to make me believe that you actually know what you're talking about? He just basically stammered.
Yeah.
And I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And I thought, and what basically it made me, it gave me a little bit of a, it seemed very Dobbs-ish in their church's sense, in the way that, you know, this was like a guy, he's published this book, like he's obviously something of a name in the conspiracy world, and he's calling into this conspiracy radio show, and what does the host do? The host is, the co-host's like, friggin', like, cutting him up, saying, like, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, and, like, being very, like, jovially dismissive of him and something, and it seemed very... So right away, perceiving that I was getting an impression of you that didn't involve any radical departure from the attitude of the church. Like,
right.
It seemed like a pretty, like, if Bob was a radio host, then he would be just as... irreverently, you know, like willing to blow off the pseudo celebrity that's calling in.
Yeah, the guest of honor, or as McLuhan would call it, the jest of honor. We were doing a guest of honor on him. And the thing is, I said, well, you're talking to somebody who was there and did these evil things, and you, what do you say to that? Ask me what happened. And he didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And that was showing totally the visual bias, the abstract literate bias of Eric Phelps. If you look into him, he's totally a worshiper of the Protestant view of the Bible, you know, the Gutenberg archetype effect, and his whole bias was shown there. He could not deal with the immediate face, the faciality of right hemisphere direct experience of the facts, because he's only going by books, because that's what the Protestant religion is built on, the printed book.
Mm-hmm.
Catholic Church is not built on the printed church. The printed book is built on the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what caused the Reformation and the split, was that Gutenberg gave a new form for the Protestant church.
Or yeah, that you can have your own private experience with the Bible. You don't have to have someone read it out loud to you.
Right. Okay, so the other aspect is, for your personal interest, is that you call in October. I'm off the show by the first week of November. Because Nelson could not take it, because Nelson is anti-Vatican, and he wants to believe Phelps stuff to prop up Nelson's personal religion, and personal sense of sacredness. So he was outraged that I made fun of Eric Phelps, okay? And so for a few weeks after that, he started, as Lenny Bloom, emailing me, saying, insulting me, blah, blah, blah. And by the time of 1st November, after he screwed up on the subsequent shows a little bit, from my point of view, I decided to quit. And that's what happened, and I went into the silence. But it was triggered by Eric Phelps, and that's the day you phoned in.
I must have had a pretty bad first impression with him then, because I thought it was, like, later that night, I was laughing to myself over, it hadn't even occurred to me that, as I was calling in, that Eric Phelps was there. Perhaps, they were supposing that the callers would be wanting to ask Aaron Phelps something. But I just called and I was like, hey, Bob, like,
great.
What do you make of this guy who doesn't even know what he's talking about?
Excellent, excellent. Which is like a total sub-genius, sub-genie response to Bob being on the air. It's like you were being the sub-genie.
And then later I'm like, oh, oops, oh, maybe that was really rude. I didn't mean it, but...
Yeah, your Canadian decency comes back in, you know.
Yeah, I don't actually want to, you know, give anyone a bad day.
Right, right, that's right. The Canadians don't want to do that. We're nice, balanced people, or you guys are, you Canadians. I was born in Paris, but I did become a Canadian citizen, but I don't know if I ever became a Canadian in mentality.
I think we actually have a vision that we, I guess, can't quite articulate, but it actually is not just totally naive, but it actually kind of look around and it's like, well, can't we all just get along?
Yeah, and we...
I mean, come on.
Yeah, come on. And then the Canadian, you know, with the help of McLuhan and Innes and Grant and everybody, George Grant, they could say, we can explain why we're not getting along, you know? We're not naive about this. This is why we're not getting along, guys. So we could get along.
Yeah, and McLuhan is like, would be like, can't all the different branches of sociology and psychology and all this get along?
That's right.
Apparently not.
Yeah, that's the interdisciplinary motif that he started. And he does say in his diary, after a couple years of it, he says, there's something stubborn in the human personality that will not allow agreement.
Yeah.
And they later developed that into realizing, he maybe knew it then, that that was the essence of the private identity created by literacy, is the ability to be stubborn, you know, and to maintain your personal point of view regardless of the facts.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, like, my very personal experience was that the medium is the message was basically the prime sort of like the unit of the conspiracy or something, that like what the conspiracy is made out of is the difference between the illusion of the content versus the real medium, as I said once in an email to you, and then I put it up on Five Bodied not too long ago, sometime this year, talking to Reverend Chuck Key, talking about how my friend and I had basically had the growing, like, we didn't need McLuhan to tell us the medium is the message to really start getting the sense, like, okay, we're going to this school and we're really not here to learn about the things they're teaching us. We're here to learn to be awake and responsive way earlier in the morning than we want to. We're here to learn to respond to bells. We're here to learn to work with people we don't want to work with. We're here to shut up and listen to teachers that we know we're smarter than. We're here to, et cetera, et cetera. That the medium of the high school is the message. Like, it's socializing you. It's like, you're going to forget everything you learn here and it doesn't fucking matter. What you're learning is to how to write an essay that, like, will slide by someone's eyes without creating any, like, big friction or something, like how to do it in the form. And so to us, it seemed 100% natural that McLuhan's basic insight was essential to studying the conspiracy. That's not the particular conspiracies, but just the conspiracy of the fact that this world in its form is, you know, screwed.
And not, invisible.
Yeah, and invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, but apparently, like, stubbornness dictates that we can't admit that perhaps McLuhan should be, you know, a saint rather than some kind of villain.
Right. Now, they do compromise. Occasionally, the truth of McLuhan overwhelms them, so they say, well, McLuhan was great, but Bob, you fuck him up. You make his name bad.
Man, if McLuhan was alive, he would hate you.
Yeah, little do they know that his daughter is working with me right now. But the
do they know that you know, Don Theol was at least as much of an authority on what's good McLuhanism as Eric McLuhan, and
as much as McLuhan, because he helped create McLuhan. He's the one introduced
him. Right there with the pre-understanding media. This investigative project.
Yeah, do you know that he introduced Ted Carpenter, which was a key meeting in 1950-51 to McLuhan, and then...
He introduced them?
Yes!
Case closed.
Yes, case closed. case closed. And then he became the, because he was smart and an American, he became the little gopher guy for the two of them in 52, 53, watched them plan to create the proposal explorations, and Don wrote the proposal.
Wow.
He is really a part of the whole thing. He is, you know, as much as McLuhan, as Ted Carpenter, anybody. So he's the authority. And he said, just before he died, he said, the mantle has been inherited by Bob. He told that to Michael Edmonds.
He said it that explicitly?
He said it to Michael Edmonds a few months before he died, because Michael moved up to Peterborough and right across the street from him, just down the street.
I felt bad that I never got in touch with Don Deal at all before he died. But anyway.
But of course,
timing.
It's okay. You met me. That's good enough. You can get all the fuel you want from me. The thing is that, of course, I'm lying, right? I'm lying. Michael Evans didn't say this, but between you and me, he did. Okay? The rest of them can say it didn't. But there was another aspect there. I do want to go, I mean, I like when you point out, I guess you did it a couple weeks ago, that for someone to take McLuhan and put it together, the Church of Genius, is a really smart thing to do. And that when you heard me on the radio, to put the McLuhan thing together with the Church of Genius, that's what impressed you. Maybe you could go into
that.
Yeah,
I mean, it seems like if I was to ask myself as a thought experiment, like, because McLuhan was a, you know, devout, in quotes, Catholic, in the sense that he felt that he was holding true to something or any number of things about Catholicism, but he certainly had almost nothing but criticism for the actual people involved in the Catholic Church structure itself.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, it's pretty radical for a Catholic to be basically saying, like, oh, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. The media, you know, like, apparently the Pope's infallibility did not give him any infallibility in regard to media.
That's right.
McLuhan.
Yeah.
So it's like, as a thought experiment, if McLuhan wanted to correct the Catholic Church, you know, how would you go about that monumental project? And it's like, not to say that the Church's subgenius is the obvious answer, but it's the only possibility out there or something. Like, the Church's subgenius actually has a number of pretty sophisticated, like, simulations of the Catholic structure of language just built into it, with the whole, always, like, erasability of any doctrine or something, and all this stuff. And, you know,
they hoik up the Peter side in the debate between Peter and Paul. Peter wanted to keep it keep the Catholic, early Christians within themselves as an inner tribe, an elite, or a secret situation. And Paul says, no, we must go out and convert the pagans, you know. So literacy favored Paul, so it could spread. But the Peter aspect is keeping it within the oral tradition. And the Stang guys are trying to retrieve the oral tradition within the meme of religious sacriosity or sacred or something's precious. And that you do not fall victim of the icons of your preciosity, you make fun of it while you teach, like it's a Zen approach. And so they're retrieving the Peter thread of Christianity.
Excellent.
Okay.
Yeah. I agree.
Okay, then, good. Now, unless you want to say more about that, I could take I could take the Book of the Subgenius and go through and show the Tetrad is in there. They don't know it. They you know that part of the book where they talk about...
I can get it right now if you want.
Yeah, it's the chart of, boredom, techno-boredom.
Yeah.
And it's like in the middle
how
of the book.
Become obsolete and get retrieved as bull data.
Exactly. That's about page 100 or so. You know what I mean? In the middle of the book. If you go through that, they've got about 5 or 8 stages. But it's someone who went to McLuhan lecture, heard the Tetrad, and was stoned and vaguely trying to remember the 4 things and comes up with 8, you know, in the confused coming down phase. That's what you got.
Yeah.
Especially since the Book of Subgenius was written on acid, you know, so it's an acidic response to a McLuhan lecture, but the tetrad is right there. I mean, I'm like St. Augustine, putting together the conceptual framework for the Christians as we move into a literate age. That's what Croker says that Augustine did. He finally bypassed the classical Greek problem and dualism and paradoxes of the mind-body or the doubleness of experience. And the Greeks get all uptight about this because the alphabet made it visual space and made the paradox a problem, whereas pre-literate people, they didn't live paradox. It wasn't a paradox because they could handle their doubleness. So so St. Augustine figured out how to get past that problem by creating a third entity, what's called the third term, the idea of an individual psyche that is above the conflict of the senses and lusts and contrarieties of physical existence. So that abstract image he created is a result of the phonetic alphabet. And so the church built on the city of God that he properly imaged, that there was an individual psyche, which became known as a soul, and that transcended the problems of oral living or pagan living. I'm the St. Augustine of the Church of Genius by explaining and making it coherent for the boardrooms.
Like, well, Augustine. There you go. I like the idea of you being the Augustine of the church better than you being the Paul of the church, as they brushed up against with some horror and left it alone sometime not too long ago on alt.slack. I remember they were like, Bob Dean is Saul of Tarsus? Oh, I don't know. It's like, well, yeah, you hadn't thought about that yet, even with me, like, reminding you, like, you know, like, who's to say that you're going to hang on to the meaning of your own thing if you've got some, like, lunatic with his own idea who's a really prolific letter writer, you know, changing it into something else? But it occurred to me at the time that I would say, if I said something, it would be, okay, but if Bob is the Paul, then I get to be the Luther and the Joseph Smith rolled into one. But I like the idea of you being the Augustine better.
Yeah, okay, good. And you know, we're quoting our holy office of Croker, so it has antecedent to say this. Mm. So is there anything more on this theme of the McLuhan subgenius overlap? And go into Wyndham Lewis. Now that's an incredible discovery, because Lewis created McLuhan.
You know, that did not, like, today, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, what am I going to talk about with these anachronies. That didn't even occur to me, that whole side of it, that it's like, I thought it was pretty astonishing to come across in one of these old blasts, or no, it was The Enemy, his newsletter, his magazine, The Enemy, where he had a whole section, like a subheading of one of the things he was talking about was Our Pink Millennium.
That's right.
Like, what now? What's going on? He was just able to intuit that pink could somehow just invoke this kind of, like, this fakeness or a sort of a, like, a half-there airspats, like, we're, like, kind of only pretending at having a culture-ness. Like, and that's Wyndham Lewis, who is the... You know, and when I first encountered your chart, you got Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, T.S. Eliot, William Butler Yeats, and James Joyce. And I'd heard of all of them, but I'd never heard of Lewis. And it was Lewis that you had aligned with McLuhan. So I'm like, okay, this guy has got to be pretty interesting. And then sure enough, that was one of the first things, or at least that issue of The Enemy was pretty much the first thing I ever read of Wyndham Lewis. So to come across that was pretty amazing.
Now, when was that? That's like 2005, 2006?
2000, yeah, I don't know. Maybe 2004 even.
Okay.
I it's very different between when I bought the book, when I came across that part, and when I said anything about it on the net. I'm not really sure.
So it was a few years ago, anyways, that you discovered this Pink Millennium motif.
And, of course, there's some prominent pictures of the guy, like, with a pipe. Oh, yeah, and here's another thing. When I was on posting things on Cloak and Dagger, at one point I came up with this, like, I arranged a string of quotes. There was about 22 quotes.
Yeah.
In a row, like, just, you know, some, like, progression of juxtaposing against each other. And one of the quotes that I had was Wyndham Lewis saying, What makes it so intolerable is that the problem is your problems are caused by your peaceable neighbor with his bald head shining in the sun, who's totally harmless and is pleasant and says something nice to you every day. Like, what makes this so intolerable is that it's that guy and people like him who are, you know, ruining everything. It's not some boogeyman that you can point at and be like, look how evil this guy is. It's a spreading bland normalcy.
Yeah.
And I put that in the quote string, and pretty much the only response I got to that quote string was from Stang saying, like, oh yeah, like a bunch of pretentious crap. And but at the time he might have still thought that because there were times he assumed that ad absurdum was another one of your names.
Yeah.
And although I've never known you to have like multiple names that you post under at the same time.
No.
Anyway, but then the thing is that exact sentiment, like reworded a bit, but the exact same thing as that quote. Was said by Nenslow somewhere in one of the Subgenius books. I forget which. I think it's Revelation X. But he basically says, like, you know, it's your problems are caused by that, like, bland, smiling pig that lives next door.
Yeah. Fantastic.
So when you say that Wyndham Lewis is the original Subgenius or something, then it sure doesn't ring too false.
Yes.
And he used the phrase somewhere, I don't know where, I can't cite it, but Wyndham Lewis used the phrase mechanical animals.
Yeah.
And I had already thought it was interesting. In Revelation X there's a few phrases. I think there's three different phrases at least in Revelation X that were borrowed by Marilyn Manson, and mechanical animals he made into the title of one of his albums. It's called Mechanical Animals. And he has a kind of a fake band that's Omega and the Mechanical Animals. And so then when I then found out that Mechanical Animals was not only in the church, it was in the book of the Subgenius, that phrase, but that it came from Wyndham Lewis, you know, it all just ties together that much more tight.
Right, and for those that don't know, Wyndham Lewis is the inspiration for McLuhan. He's the guy that inspired Joyce and forced Pound to change and Eliot to change. He's the one who really began to see the meeting was the message. And he was ostracized for that. He suffered the ostracization that supposedly J.R. Bob Dobbs is experiencing at some point. He really did act it out.
And Wyndham Lewis is a good flashpoint for my, like, annoyance at the just knee-jerk, like, anti-highbrow aspect of the Church of Subgenius, because it's like, okay, on the one hand, maybe, you know, you're presented with a Wyndham Lewis quote, and you think that it's, like, pretentious garbage, or that, you know, just that the highbrowness of the expression somehow subverts the anything that you might try to say, because it's just too caught up in itself. Then again, I'm like, I read the first novel that I read of his was The Children Ask and The Human Aid, and the thing is so loony, it's off the wall, especially right near the beginning.
Yeah.
That I'm just like, clearly this guy's a subgenius. Like, this is a weird-ass book. Like, this is weird science fiction. Like, you know, why is it so wrong to think to like this? You know?
Yeah. He's doing Burroughs before Burroughs or any other weird science fiction guy of the 70s and 80s, Lewis did it first in 1928.
Yeah.
And the Child of Mass, that section, that weird section, is 122 pages.
Really?
Yeah. It becomes 123, so it even includes the 22-23 battle. You know what I mean? It kind of ends in 22, but maybe slips a few lines into 23, you know, just to bug people.
In that interval?
Yeah, in the interval.
Okay. Honestly, this the Xenocrony talk could get pretty bogged down in the whole, like, what's wrong with the Church of Subgenius thing. So I don't want to throw the Subgenii out of it, but I want to kind of get off harping on that line.
Okay.
And I want to talk something about that happened today. A couple of things that happened today, actually. When I went to the internet to check a couple of things, like what was the date when this was said, and then I responded. To two things. I responded to Hex or Keith, I responded to him on All But Slack, and I responded to Freighter 222 on Five Bodies.
Yeah.
And on All But Slack, it was because Reverend Discord Reborn, Keith.
Yeah. Or Hexbody, or Denmu, or Kiyi 888. That's his four names. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he was going on this line about, you know, he's talking about algebra, yes, geometry, no.
Yeah.
It's basically, you know, the fundamental line there. And he was ranting about the Platonic solids. And he said the strangest thing. I guess he's got some reason for it that maybe said before, so he presumes people know, but I didn't know. Talking about how the icosahedron is lethal.
Yes.
Which, to me, that's just great comedy. That belongs on All But Slack. The guy's saying that a geometrical structure is lethal. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And the reason he explained it, if he didn't in this, you're talking about today's post.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a few days ago, he pointed out the icosahedron is the basic structure of a virus. And virus is a strange discovery in 20th century science. And he said, of course, Bob Dean puts his quadrant in the icosahedron, and definitely Bob Dean's a virus, and he also created AIDS. So, and he's Rumpelstiltskin. People, come on! We got problems here! We got to deal with this, Bob Dean! That's what he's talking about the icosahedron.
Case closed, with a negative spin on it. Anyway, that's perfect, because what it reminded me of is I was reading Buckminster Fuller's Synergetics.
Yeah.
And that's doubly perfect because he begins that book right in the preface talking about viruses. So, but I thought it was interesting reading that book that Buckminster Fuller is very enamored of this geometrical structure that he calls the vector equilibrium.
Yes.
I think that the proper name for it is like a cube octahedron or something, but I might have that wrong. Anyway, and he kind of, there's parts of it, like I almost get the sense that he would like to throw out one of the Platonic solids and replace it with the vector equilibrium.
Yeah.
And I forget which one it was. It was either the icosahedron or the dodecahedron that he wanted to throw out. So I thought if it turned out to be the icosahedron, that would be perfect. Because the vector equilibrium, basically I wanted to ask Keith, like, okay, is this geometry? Because it's not just like the spatial relationship. It's not a Platonic solid with the totally regular side, but it's a structure that Fuller came up with by basically, if you take a sphere and then pack 12 other spheres around it as close as possible, other spheres of the same size, and you connect the centers of all those spheres, you get this shape. And, like, maximum stability makes it the vector equilibrium. And so I mentioned that. And then when later on, like, I'd been looking at other stuff, and then I wanted to... And then I called up All But Slack again, and I wanted to find what I had just posted. I didn't remember what the thread was called, so I typed into the search. I typed in vector equilibrium. And it turns out that one of the people, pretty sure he's still on there, St. Bucky something.
Yeah,
the
he comes
from Nova Scotia.
You're asking me?
Is that what you were going to say?
No. St. Bucky lives up in Buffalo, maybe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think he might be a Canadian or lives very close to Buffalo, but that's who I think St. Bucky is. But anyways, what's your point on him?
Okay, well, I guess I might be confusing him with someone else, but it would be doubly perfect if he was the one from Nova Scotia, because apparently his name used to be St. Bucky of the Vector Equilibrium. It was that came out. I typed in Vector Equilibrium, and I figured there weren't too many posts on All But Slack about that, and that's what I just said. And that he changed his name from that right about the time that I first showed up there. So that's just like a minor little coincidence that happened to me today because I was looking into this or something. Like I said vector equilibrium, and then I went back and noticed that the guy, I thought anyway, it was the guy from Nova Scotia, maybe I'm wrong, used to be known as that.
What do you...
It's just, these are the inescapable things. Like, to me, that guy saying, like, that the guy riding by and seeming to comment on what I just read and then that happening, those are pretty, you know, I give them a 7 or something. Like, they don't... they might seem, they're pretty good, but they're really nothing compared to the kinds of things that tend to happen, like the piling up of, on April 4th of 2006, on 4-4, the cover of the Toronto Sun said, "Free Bob!" It was about this moose head named Bob that was, like, stuck somewhere. I forget why. Some stupid story. But they put it right on the cover for 4-4. and then later that day, I found out that Zappa Plays Zappa were going to be coming to Toronto and playing on Bloomsday.
Oh.
So it's like, bam! You know, like, there's better coincidences that happen than, you know, when I got, like, it was a pretty good harvest today. The Vector Equilibrium thing and the guy riding by, like, that's pretty nice. Oh, yeah, and that right after you called earlier, right after I talked to you earlier today, I, like, hung up the phone, and then almost immediately the randomizer on the iTunes went over to the one song. There's only one track that's a recording of the first show that I played with Slaughtering Anus back on Leap Day 2004. That first thing was a bit. So a 1 in 16 chance that would come up. You know, and so those three together, that's pretty good. But it's only pretty good. It's not really that impressive compared to some of the other stuff that I experienced. Because the other thing was when it Leap Day of this year, all those things happening on Leap Day this year, those almost seemed to be caused by the fact that I was building up to getting together with Andrew, Convulsionaire. It wasn't the first time that I'd met him, but we got together and, like, basically had a really exhausting marathon session of sharing all these Xenocrates that had been happening.
When did that happen? So,
Leap Day of this year. So, as well as the Ewan Joan talking about Fing His Wake and Polar Bear quitting alt.slack was the same day as me and Andrew getting together and talking at length about all the Xenocrates twists and turns that we've been having.
Yeah, was he just coming back from New York?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
well, I have a pretty indistinct memory of that.
Let me see. No,
I don't remember precisely.
No, yeah, he goes down to be with Joan in October, and he comes and sees me after he leaves Joan, and comes to New York, and we have a neat evening there, and then he goes to Toronto and he hangs out there for a few weeks, and that must be the period he saw you. Yeah, he's on his way. He's leaving the United States and he's going to go work out in British Columbia. So that's he had just come for me when he met you, when you had your February 29th experience with him.
Yeah.
And there was all kinds of synchronicity when we got together that time in New York in February. But what was the thing just... Oh, yeah. The April 4th, that's 2006. So you got 4-4 and 2006, 2-6 is 8. There's your 8-8. 4-4 is 8. There's your 16. And then you put the 2 in front of it. Didn't you just mention 16, I think, 2 minutes ago?
Well, there are 16 tracks on my iTunes, and you were talking about how you were meditating on the 16 lately.
Yes, and what is the song that came up?
Oh, just the recording, a low quality recording that my friend made of a fragment of our performance that day at the Leap Day 2004.
Right,
at a place called the Culture Vacuum.
Okay, then, and the parallel to that. This is part of the collection of CDs that you got from Stang's main ally at CKLN. Sasha is the guy with Bachner broadcasting our Slack for many years, the last, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. Sasha's not doing it right now. There's a whole parallel to Sasha and his involvement with Kenzie, your friend, and you meeting Kenzie right when she's with one of the main mentors to Sasha.
Yeah, definitely, definitely he's tied into it, and I had no idea that he, like, I've known him for a while, and I would have contributed to a zine that he put out a few years ago if I hadn't just, you know, missed the boat and drop the ball and miss the deadline on submitting something. And so, yeah, he's really tied up in it. And, yeah, I've got, I had only ever heard 1 hour of Slack. And then, so the second to, like, 30-something hour of Slack I've ever heard were his archives. So I had some of his CDs. But also, he had CDs of not only Bob's Musicology, but Dave Neufeld's McLuhan album, which I'd never heard.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, just another example of, like, you know, hey, folks, it's possible for people with Slack to, you know, like all sorts of things, including the Bob's Musicology and, like, Dave Neufeld stuff, like, you know. The people with Slack are comprehensivists, and they like whatever's good.
That's
you know,
right.
They don't say, like, oh, that's a, that has Dean stains on it. It stinks bad. There's no way I'm going to...
Yeah, ween stains, Dean and Ween. But the thing is that, yeah, Sasha, who helped promote Stang's Hour of Slack, had Bob Dean stuff in his collection. And the collection was found in your building?
Yeah, it was. He was, Sasha was either living or staying, like, I should probably know exactly, but he was either living or staying with someone next door who got evicted, and we, like, saved these CDs from being thrown out.
Because they were sitting there in an empty room, and it was being cleaned out, so Kenzie found them and asked for them, and they said, yeah, you can have them. And then that clinched the full circle, because Kenzie is getting the collection of the guy she was involved with, Sasha, indirectly through, what's his name, Mishlo?
Miklos.
What?
Miklos.
Miklos, right.
Emma.
Yeah. And so she's with him, then meets you, and then... You are primed to appreciate the Church of Jesus because you'd studied it, and then you get the McLuhan overlay, and you end up in this strange agon from 2003 to now, and it comes back, proving your point with Sasha's example, but it began 5 years ago with Sasha.
Yeah.
Think of that.
Or with him involved, anyway.
Yeah.
Like, in
yeah.
close orbit. And, like, I was, it was Miklos's computer that I did, like, around April 2004, like, it was the other 4-4, when I sent my money to Stang and got it back.
On April 4th?
At that time,
on April 4th you sent the money?
I sent it on April 1st, actually.
And you got it back?
I don't know exactly what date. A little later. It was past the 4th.
But
That whole period of me posting on all that Slack, I was posting from Miklos's house. And then it occurred to me, like, you know, there's just something, it really says something about, you know, it occurred to me, oh, maybe these people are, you know, they're internet savvy, like someone looking up my IP address and seeing that I'm posting from the same IP address that hosts Istvan Kantor's site, for example, the Toronto-based artist involved in Neoism,
yeah.
Or who, I don't think he created, but he was like the most energetic user of this name, this collective artist named Monty Canson,
yeah.
That like could be described as like the Canadian J.R. Bob Dobbs in a way,
yeah.
Or something. So I'm like, well, like, it occurs to me at some point, like, maybe these people think I'm that guy, or am I involved in that? Like, if they have some kind of distorted surveillance of trying to read too much into my IP address or something. Like,
yeah.
So, you know, that ties into the whole thing.
Right. Now, let me read page 37, the bottom, going to page 38 of McLuhan's 1953 essay, James Joyce, Trivial and Quadrivial, which is in the collection called The Interior Landscape, you know, the collection of McLuhan's early literary criticism. He says, the conventional meanings of words can thus be used or disregarded by Joyce, who is concentrating on the submerged metaphysical drama which these meanings often tend to overlay. His puns in Finnegan's Wake are a technique for revealing this submerged drama of language, and Joyce relied on the quirks, slips in quotes, flips and freaks of ordinary discourse to evoke the fullness of existence in speech. All his life he played the sleuth with words, shadowing them and waiting confidently for some unexpected situation to reveal their hidden signatures and powers. for his view of the poet was that he should read, not forge, the signature of things. But the point is, he's waiting for synchronicity, for things that he knows will show up. And that's like, fuck yeah, when the guy's driving by. Now, McLuhan takes this, the drama of language, covered over by ordinary meanings, he sees that it's a drama of post-linguistic media, and that the drama of television and movie and the whole collection that Joyce lays out in Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan translates, that drama on a multimedia level is the xenarchy we're talking about in today's experience, and so you wait confidently for more xenarchy to happen in the, quote, media in relation to me and anything else that comes up. That's, and
yeah.
This, you might want to, you know, take a look at that. Bottom of page 37, top of 38 of Interior Landscape. There is McLuhan fully cognizant of what the, quote, artist sees, you know?
For sure. For sure, yes. And I quite confidently, you know, wait for more. I don't even have to wait for more. It shows up in greater deluges than I could even write down and articulate. Like, for example, yet another thing. The first time that Ad Absurdum posted on Five Bodied, because at first it was Linus Minimax on there. But then the first time that Ad Absurdum posted, later that day, so I just posted for the first time on Five Bodied that way. Later that day, I'm walking around, and around, like, Dufferin Street. Yeah, it was on Dufferin Street. And then literally blowing along on the street. There's some, like, section of a newspaper that's all disheveled and just on the street, blowing along. And right in front of me, so that just by walking and looking down at my feet, I see this, because I don't read the paper generally. There's this thing, it says, it's a picture of these smokestacks falling, and it says, after 44 years, the four sisters take a bow.
Wow.
And I had never heard, like, I'd commuted in and out of Toronto on the train passing by these four smokestacks. I never knew they were known as the Four Sisters, and I didn't know that they'd been demolished, but I learned it that day. So I happened to post the day after they fell, but the same day that the paper printed this thing with the caption, after 44 years, the Four Sisters take a bow. So that, you know, I mean, I can't avoid it. Like, I didn't have to go and read the paper. I didn't have to have someone else tell me about it because they'd read the paper. It literally blew in front of me as I was walking down the street.
Like, you're a strange attractor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I just had to know.
And
Xenarchy. I had to phrase it that way.
Yeah. And Xenarchy means strange synchronicity. So the strange...
Yeah, and there was a... Sorry, go ahead.
The strangeness factor. This, what had you posted on Five Body? Did it connect to this headline in any way?
That's a good question.
Probably something about 44. I recall you talking about 44 in one of your earliest posts.
It was probably something about the Churches of Genius, anyway. Because I think I then, like, because Ad Absurdum is more, like, it was Ad Absurdum that, like, you know, sticks a knuckle into the pressure point of all Bud Flack
yeah.
a lot more than Linus Minimax ever did. And so Ad Absurdum on Five Bodied was going to talk about the Churches of Subgenius. You know, if there's a pressure point there for the readers there that, like, say, I don't know, because I find it astonishing that, like, you know, no offense anyone, but I find it pretty astonishing that a lot of your students seem to want to just, you know, think of Churches of Genius as completely irrelevant to you or something, or half irrelevant. But so I, you know, was emphasizing them on there, and then that happened to me. But there was a bunch of 44 stuff with Ad Absurdum and Churches of Genius. For example, there was another big 44 thing that happened where, yeah, this was a pretty awesome one for that ties into the, like, strange synchronicity and synchronicities that happen needing to, like, in your cloning ESP article, you talk about how there needs to be an escalation, there needs to be an upping of the stakes as
yeah.
people get used to synchronicity. It has to get weirder so that we're still impressed.
Exactly.
This is what I'm about to say. The story, in a second, is a perfect example of it. which was that I'd been reading a bunch of stuff by this guy, Robert Young Pelton. He wrote this book, The World's Most Dangerous Places, that apparently became something of a, uncommissioned, like an unsolicited CIA manual. Like, they would just say, oh, this book's good enough, read this, because the guy had, like, traveled to all sorts of, like, the most dangerous places he could find and done his own on-the-ground, like, using his body as a probe, research of how dangerous are these places, what are things like, that you're not just going to read about from some what the government's going to tell you about what's going on there. So then I'm reading his biography, and he's got in there, he's got an image, one of the photos, he's got his passport, and that includes his, not only his city of birth, which is Edmonton, which already piqued my interest because McLuhan was born there.
Yeah.
That this guy, Robert Young Pelton, was born there, but it had his birthday on there, on the passport. And I noticed pretty quickly, that he was born in Edmonton 44 years and 4 days after McLuhan was.
Wow.
So July 25th, 1955.
Right.
And so I thought, wow, that's a really great coincidence. Total 44, right in there with McLuhan and this other guy that I think is, like, you know, relevant somehow because he shows up with his body rather than monitoring the media to get this scoop.
Right. Let me just supplement that with the title is the 100. What is it? The dangerous places in the world. What is it? The title?
The world's most dangerous places. And he updates it every few years. The new editions come out.
McLuhan's expertise was to point out where the flashpoints were and why they were. He was pointing out where abrasions and the rubbing of information against information and culture against culture would create dangerous liaisons, you know, laid down as liaisons. Actually, you could say McLuhan spent studying the TV landscape and previous media landscapes, pointing out the danger flashpoints. So it actually makes sense this guy follows from the McLuhan-Edmonton zone.
Yeah. Yeah, perfect. And then, so then, here's, that was enough for me to think, like, oh, great, confirmed with this coincidence of 44 years and 4 days.
Right.
But then, so I show up on the internet, and I check Robert Young Pelton's site, and I was maybe interested to join their discussion forum or something, but I didn't know what I would say, because, you know, that discussion forum is more like hardcore adventurers and, like, I don't know, like,
fishermen.
Yeah. Not like I have no business being there for the most part.
Yeah.
So I don't really have anything to say to these people for the most part. But I checked it, and it's a very fast-moving forum. But right when I happened to show up, there was a thread that had been started a couple days earlier by someone started. They're just like what famous people were born in the same city that you were? And Pelton himself responded, saying, like, oh, yeah, well, I'm from Edmonton, so it's not too many people. We got Leslie Nielsen, we got Michael J. Fox, and someone else, but he clearly didn't know McLuhan. So I'm like, wow, like, I would never have expected I actually would have something to say.
Yeah, to contribute.
Here is like, hey, dude, Marshall McLuhan was born in Edmonton. So there was that.
You did do that. You did post that.
I did, but a single issue poster, the only thing I ever posted that. But then the same day, I check alt.flack, and Ivan Stang posts a link from some new, he was like, someone forwarded me this news article, and it was about how after 44 years, the city of Edmonton had some kind of yearly festival. And the news item was that after 44 years of this festival having a certain one name, now they're changing the name to something that sounded very much like X Day. It was like X Fest or something like that. And so, you know, that's
a good one.
That's pretty friggin' good. So that's like a well upped stakes. Like at first I thought it was good enough, but then those two just really upped the stakes on it. Those two coincidences.
Right.
And of course, I said something about it on alt.slack, and people are basically like, quit fucking geeking out with this shit that has nothing to do with our church.
Well, okay, so you're an...
I only said it.
What?
It's like, okay, I just mentioned it.
Yeah. It's like you're in an invisible environment. You're in the know between me and Stang because Stang has noticed you. He says he's the only deity who can write, so I will kind of respond to him. That's what he used to say a couple of years ago. And so he does. You end up saying things. He says, okay, give me some better journalism than the one that we use. The point is he takes you seriously. Whether he knows or not, he knows that you are a good lightning rod for potential trouble, and he needs to monitor you because you are in the know. You know a lot about their stuff. You know a lot about me, and you're in the middle, and you're just the Niagara Falls of Xenocrity is about the two environments is going through you all the time.
Yeah. Plus, I've made it clear that I'm, like, fairly sympathetic and that, you know, if you're not going to take something from what I'm saying towards, like, you should pay attention to purple, then at least I'm saying something like you should maybe not rest on a retarded assumption about who this guy is, because this whole thing of how carelessly you're dealing with this situation might end up really biting you in the ass, because, you know, believe it or not, some people seem to think that you guys look like the idiots in this situation, and I sure don't blame them.
Yeah, and you're a double agent. You're actually saying, look, I could be, if I was allowed to be a member of your church, I support your church, I was influenced by it, and we are going to get nailed by this, Bob Dean. You're a more calm version of Kidney. He is, you know, he's screaming at them right now, saying, you fucking guys, this guy is the conspiracy, we must deal with him. And you're doing it in a calm way, saying, well, wait a minute, guys, you know, we could be embarrassed by this guy, this Dean, if we don't notice this stuff. That's what you're actually doing.
Yeah, and if you, on the contrary, if you, you know, figure out how to take the joke, you know, this guy could just as easily be a fantastic advertisement for the church, you know, whether it's like, you know, like the guy who went all the way career crazy on the Church of the Subgenius, if not anything better, you know? No.
I'll give you a date, August 26, 08. Just a few weeks ago, 888, August, the 8th month, 26 is 8, and 08. The 888, you know, Kiki calls himself 888, so that's pretty prophetic. But that date, in 10 years, is going to lead to a lot of things that's going to make these guys say, man, we should have claimed him as our own. That's what I'm telling you. A little exclusive here. A little prediction.